Hello, and welcome to the Press Gallery, the Edmonton Journal's Alberta Politics Podcast. It's Friday, November 1st, 2019, and this is episode 296, the Routing Alberta Labour Edition. I am your host, Janet French. Eating leftover Halloween candy in the studio with me today is, making her podcast debut in the southeast corner. I have no idea if it's a southeast corner. Lisa Johnson.
Hi, Janet.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm alive. What's your favorite Halloween candy?
My favorite Halloween candy right now is Mars bars.
Good choice.
It's just a little chewy nugget of chocolatey goodness.
More adjectives, please.
It's a good serving size. I don't want to overdo it.
Fair enough. Recovering from Halloween, next to her is our editor, Dave Breckenridge. How are you?
Good. She's in the northwest corner.
Oh, whatever. I didn't bring my compass. What's your favorite Halloween candy?
I have a soft spot for Kerr's Molasses Kisses, which nobody likes.
Oh, boy.
They're very good.
Oh, you like? Nope. We were just talking about these. You legitimately like them?
I do like them. But when it comes to the stuff that I'll be taking out of my kid's candy bag over the next few days, I'm hunting for the Reese peanut butter cups, mm-hmm. or maybe... because I don't have them all that often, a Twix, a mini Twix.
Oh, those are rare. Those are rare
Twix
in the bag.
Yeah, those are tasty. Mm-hmm. The man who tried to avoid Halloween entirely.
Successfully, actually.
Yeah. Legislative columnist Keith DeRine, how are you?
I'm doing very well.
What candy did you not eat yesterday?
Well, yeah, no, I tend to maybe go for the Smarties a bit, but honestly, my favorite Halloween memories is the woman on my street who would put an entire large full-size O. Henry bar in my Halloween bag. That was yes. always my favorite. Had to hit up her house every
Aww.
Year. Sometimes I tried to go back twice, but she usually caught me.
Halloween
when I was
heroes.
A kid, I was lucky to get one full-size chocolate bar. My daughter got six.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Good haul.
Inflation.
Sloan. Good haul. Yeah, no kidding. It's hard these days to hand out candy.
Yeah, I don't think Jason Kenney would approve of that.
Ooh, we'll get there.
All right.
So today, we're in addition to candy analysis, we're going to talk about, it was a tough week to be in the public sector in Alberta. It was an interesting week for organized labor. And also, we will talk about some of the omnibus legislation that was brought in to try and implement last week's budget. It turns out there's a whole laundry list of legislative changes that need to be made in order for the United Conservative Party government to do the things that they want to do. Also, we're going to talk about something very technical, but very important to our future, and that is the TIER Fund, which is the replacement for the industrial carbon tax in Alberta. That stands for Technology Innovation and Emissions Reduction Program. But first, let's talk about labor and some of the things that happened this week for workers who have been receiving a series of interesting signals from this government. It's been a challenging time. The budget last week included a 7.7% cut over 4 years for public sector workers in Alberta. Sorry, I should say public workers with the public service, so government workers. And then the budget also hinted at some proposed change to their pension plans, which I wrote about in today's paper. You should all read it. It's long and complicated and very interesting. And also, the government wants to lift a ban on replacement workers, which the NDP had brought in with their labor legislation. And finally, on Tuesday, we had the classic bad news release, which was bury the lead down about 9 paragraphs of the thing that actually matters. So you're reading through, you're like, why? So the news release started off saying like, yeah, so we had this bill that delayed arbitration for several public sector unions, and that delay lifts on October 31st. So the delay is done. And by the way, we're changing our position at arbitration and asking unions for an average 2% wage rollback. So then we went running around for a bit trying to find the finance minister, and we learned that yes, he is seeking going back to arbitration, the government or agents who bargain directly with workers, so like Alberta Health Services, and I guess school boards possibly would be going back to arbitration asking for either some wage reduction somewhere between 2% and 5%, when I think some of these unions were actually hoping for raises. So, Lisa, can you tell us a little bit about how some of the union groups reacted to this news?
Sure. Well, the union I spoke to yesterday, the United Nurses of Alberta, was taken by surprise. Back in February, they had proposed a 3% increase in wages, while AHS, their employer, had proposed a 0% increase. So that's what they were going into this expecting. And at the budget last week, was that last week?
Oh, yeah.
It was.
Oh, my goodness.
Felt like last year, but
yeah.
It was last week.
Sands through the hourglass. In the budget, on budget day, the finance minister also reiterated, we're looking at a 0% wage increase. Now, this week, we've learned that the government is going to be pursuing a more of a wage decrease, like you mentioned. So in response, the nurses union has decided to take a complaint to the Alberta Labor Relations Board before they go into arbitration, which isn't actually until November 22nd, but we're in that kind of middle stage leading up to arbitration.
And they're saying that the government via AHS, Alberta Health Services, is breaking the rules, right? They're saying it's the United Nurses Association believes that it's not legal. United Nurses of Alberta? Was that what UNA stands
United Nurses of Alberta.
I'm really bad at the acronyms sometimes. The nurses say that they think that this is not legal, that you can't enter into arbitration, say, we're seeking 0%, and then come back later and say, oh, we changed our mind, you guys.
That's right. Yeah. Numbers aside, it's a procedural issue. It's bargaining in bad faith, they argue, to change the numbers at this stage in the game when you'd already laid out a number back in February.
And why the nurses? I mean, we've got lots of different labor groups in here, correctional officers, government workers, civil servants, teachers, whatever.
Well, I asked the president, Heather Smith, that question, and she said, we're the first up to bat. She said, this is something we knew we had to do, so we weren't going to sit around and wait for another union to take this dispute to the labor board.
Well, I guess the other unions will be watching pretty closely to see what happens, hey? Keith wrote a column this week. Why are you laughing?
I write a column every week.
Three sometimes. More than three.
Yeah.
Keith wrote a column on Thursday about kind of itemizing the blows or wounds. What were they using the words like bludgeon?
Yeah.
Things that are, I'm laughing out of the vocabulary, not out of the effect on the public sector, just FYI. Itemizing some of the things that the government has taken with regards to their relationship with labor unions. What kind of pattern have you noticed here?
Yeah, well, I mean, I kind of wanted to kind of put together since the UCP came to power in May, what have been all the moves against the labor movement, right? And there have been quite a lot. They've been sort of spread out, so it's hard to sort of see the forest for the trees. But, I mean, it started basically as soon as they formed government. Bill 2, their second bill, was to lower the minimum wage for students, to reduce the rate of banked overtime, change the rules around holiday pay. So that was there. Then that was Bill 9, as you mentioned before, which was to delay the arbitration talks until the fall. There was a minimum wage review panel that was stacked with a lot of folks friendly to the government's position. That hasn't reported back, but there's a lot of worry that could come in with a new reduced minimum wage for servers. We'll see what happens there. And then with this budget, obviously, you know, there's some layoffs, some attrition, some just general reductions in the government workforce that are coming. And then we saw these bills 20 and 21, and there's a ton of stuff in there, right? You mentioned the ban on replacement workers. You mentioned some of the things they're doing around pensions. And then they came at us with this idea that they're going to seek salary rollbacks. Now, this is an arbitration process, right? So it's up to the arbiter, to decide eventually what unions will get for this coming year. And, you know, to his credit, Travis Taves, the finance minister, says he will respect that process. So that is the government's opening negotiating position, is that, you know, a 2 to 5% rollback. But that obviously isn't going to sit well with the unions. As we heard from the UNA, they're going to the Labor Relations Board. They will not be the last. There will be others going there. There will be court cases. This is going to get quite nasty. The thing I find most disturbing about this is not that the government is seeking wage rollbacks. I think they've been signaling that for a while. It's that they are doing this negotiation in public, right? So they have come out with their negotiating position in the open, and then they've started to point to what the union's positions are as well, right? So AUPE, that was the one that Jason Kenney specifically mentioned, they are seeking for some of their bargaining units increases of somewhere between 6.5% and 7.85%. And I think Kenney looks at this and goes, the public is going to find this insane. And he's right. That is an insane thing to ask for in this political climate. And so he believes that in the court of public opinion, where I think a lot of this is going to be decided, he's in the right, and the government's ask of a slight or a small wage rollback is going to seem far more reasonable in comparison to what the unions are asking for.
And I asked you this earlier this week, but why do you think it's problematic to bargain in public?
Well, it does happen occasionally, but I think a lot of this is about public relations. So if you bargain in secret, I think there is more room for negotiations. Both parties can come out claiming a victory. Hey, we worked hard, we got what we wanted. But that's because you don't know what their starting positions were. So sometimes a union or a government may have lost that negotiation, but you'd never know because you don't know what their starting position is. Now we know that the gap is so wide, and we know where everybody is. So for the union to retreat and accept a zero or even a small wage rollback is going to seem like a major, major loss for them, or vice versa. If the government has to accept a wage increase of some sort, that's going to seem like a loss for them. I think it just really entrenches those positions and makes it harder to do negotiations.
Dave, it seems like the government's approach to labor is they're not kind of trying to hide how, you know, aggressive, is that the right word, or just is it bold? Why do you think they're taking this particular approach to the public sector?
I find it kind of interesting. I was at the Premier's State of the Province address at the Edmonton Convention Center on Tuesday, I believe it was. It's been a long week, a long 3 weeks when you factor in election and budget and all that nonsense. And Jason Kenney was talking in his speech about wanting to work together with the public sector to find those great enterprising ideas to help Alberta save money, to help reduce the debt, help get us back to balance. And we're partners with the public service. We look forward to working with them to help, you know, get Alberta back on track. And then later that day, the release came with the 2-5% wage rollback proposal. It's interesting that the government is trying to play it both ways. Although I agree with Keith that, you know, the idea that some bargaining units were coming at the government looking for 6% or higher wage increases when the government has signaled that they're trying to reduce spending. I get that they've had freezes for many years. I understand that. I understand why they would want to see some increases, but at the same time, it's a bit rich to say like, hey, Alberta, you know, you've had it tough. We've also had it tough, but cut us a break here. And I can see why they'd take that argument public. It makes sense to appeal to the people who voted for you that you're trying to do the right thing for Alberta and this group is not on board with our plan. That makes sense. That said, I don't know how they negotiate, either side negotiates in a constructive manner when there is all this back and forth going on in public. You've set up a process to be combative to begin with. And maybe that's what the government wants. Maybe the government is spoiling for a fight, just as I think a lot of public sector unions after the election were raring for a fight with the government. And I don't think this is a new thing. I think that there were a lot of people who were upset when Kenney was elected and maybe they were worried about what it meant for negotiations or staff size or anything. On the flip side, you know, what if they decide, okay, well, the arbitrator gives them a raise. Well, I guess we're going to cut staff. Like, yeah, from the government's perspective, maybe response. This is a way to save jobs while saving money and not laying off staff. I don't know.
And that's, I think that was an interesting response from the the nurses is that they said, yeah, we've heard this line before. It's like they see it as almost a threat that, oh, if you get a wage increase, then, well, we only have so many dollars, so then we're going to cut staff. But, you know, this is a government that campaigned on protecting frontline services. Mm-hmm. So how do you square that, Cyril? I don't know.
It's tricky, though. Like, you know, I know this is a private sector situation, but I remember people that I knew who my age group who worked part-time at Safeway when Safeway went on strike and the union didn't want any wage rollbacks. So all these part-time workers got let go. So the full-time staff could get their wage hikes, right? Like it's tricky that either way, the boss will find ways to save money, whether it's through rollbacks or job losses and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to move on. Everybody grab candy. Candy
I can hear your rustling.
I know I'm
rustling,
so I'm like sending you guys a hint. Like, eat the candy, you guys, so I can kind of talk with my mouth full. Moving on to Bill 20 and 21. Oh, Lisa's got Mars. Dave's got, who knows? What you got there?
I have an arrow. A teeny tiny arrow.
Those things are addictive, man, yeah. Because it's like, oh, it's so tiny. I can eat like 50 of them and there's no calories. Yeah, that's a lie.
My Smarties box has only orange and brown.
Excuse me, they're Scaries or something. Mm-hmm. Scaries, is that what they're called?
No red, no green.
I'm eating rockets and choking. It's cool. Okay, so on Monday, you know what's a really hard way to wake up on a Monday morning? Is to walk into a room with like 50 civil servants from like 9 zillion ministries. And then have someone hand you a list of 35 legislative changes. And then you have to put that in one news story.
It's why I drink coffee.
Right? There was coffee. Keith said it tasted terrible. But that is exactly what happened on Monday morning is in order to implement their inaugural budget, the government has to make a whole bunch of legislative tweaks, including modifying 26 pieces of legislation, axing one's legislation on city charters and introducing 3 new pieces of legislation. So they did that with these omnibus bills, and we have this very long list. So some of the changes, there is no way we could list all of them right now here in this podcast, but you can read our extensive coverage online. Some of the ones that spring to mind are that the government is freezing income tax brackets. So if your salary goes up, normally, income tax brackets move up with inflation over time so that you don't get penalized by getting pushed into the next tax bracket or your personal amount that you can claim for free without paying tax. That normally moves up a little bit each year to account for inflation. That is not happening if this legislation passes. Also, they did the same thing by de-indexing AISH payment. That's assured income for the severely handicapped. Those payments... The NDP made a change last year so that those payments would grow with inflation. Those are now frozen if the legislation passes. They, as I mentioned, the government is cutting up the legislation to grant the cities of Edmonton and Calgary city charters, which give them a special deal on infrastructure funding. And also some weird little things showed up in here, such as changing the powers the justice minister has to spend money collected by municipalities when they issue like fines and stuff like speeding tickets. So that was like, huh? Also allowing the government to give the final approval of any contracts that, say, universities, for example, would sign with workers when they negotiate deals. I mean, government's always kind of had the puppet strings in the back room, but now they're just being blunt about it. It's like, hey, we need to approve those contracts before you sign them. It's our money too. So, Keith, did anything on this long list come as a surprise to you?
Yeah, there were a few things. So, I mean, you mentioned the fact that the government is moving here to capture a little bit more of the fine revenue that municipalities collect. So anytime you get a parking ticket or you ride the LRT without a proper fare or something like that, you get a ticket. And the government, the province, collects that money on behalf of the municipality. And the rate that they have been collecting is about 27%. That's been standard. And they've been saying that that is the rate they need to kind of offset their costs. Now the government has created legislation or is creating legislation that says, you know, maybe we can collect a little bit more of that, right? We think we could, it gives the power of the minister to set pretty much whatever rate he wants, and they can use that money for other priorities within the justice system, whether to, you know, to keep the lights on in the courthouses, pay more prosecutors, whatever they want to do. So a lot of money then, therefore, being that would have gone to municipalities to pay for bylaw enforcement, city policing, is now theoretically instead going to go to the province. So I think that is something I didn't see. I think municipalities who also already took a pretty big hit in this budget are a little up in arms about that. Calgary mayor, for example. So that was in there. The fact that they have also put this clause in the LRT funding agreement, this cutoff clause, or as Mayor Don Iveson called it, a guillotine clause.
Yeah, that became quite a thing this week.
It really did, right? So the government is arguing this is standard in their funding agreements. I think we're still looking to find out if that's true or not, but the mayor certainly didn't think it was. And essentially it gives the province a 90-day window to cut off funding for an LRT deal.
For no reason at all.
That's right.
Like, without cause. We shouldn't feel like funding that
right.
LRT.
Cool. So this seems on its face ridiculous. Now, maybe this has been a part of contracts in the past, but it does seem ridiculous. And the mayor's point is, how can you go to tender for a $2 billion project if there is a switch in there that can be thrown at any time for any reason to cut off funding after 90 days? What company is going to agree to that? So we'll see how this plays out. The Calgary mayor is also upset because this applies to the Green Line project in Calgary. So I think those are two big surprises for municipalities in there.
Now, on the LRT funding, I get, you know, if this hasn't been in past deals, the Mayor Iveson statement leads me to believe that this hasn't been in past deals where infrastructure or transportation minister Rick McIver. I can't,
transportation.
Yeah, I get confused. Apologies
me too.
To Mr.
I think Prasad Panda is infrastructure.
Yes. So Rick McIver has said this is standard in government contracts. The one thing, though, that I will say that, again, I was at Jason Kenney's State of the City address, and he specifically spoke of Edmonton's LRT and how it is a priority project. And even though that the funding is being spread out over more years, it's something the government intends to fund and see built. So weigh that against this clause, you know, I'd like to give him the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, he says it's going to go forward, so let's see that go forward. But I can understand why the mayors would say, whoa. Wait a second.
Mixed signals.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're confused. Oh, I thought you were going to eat more candy, which you should.
Yes. I'm just turning myself down a bit. Carson's going to have fun editing this.
Oh, he sure levels up, levels down, levels up, levels down.
There's one other thing, too, that's worth mentioning. This has to do with physicians, right? So this was a bit of a surprise as well. There is an issue with physician costs, right? And the McKinnon report definitely suggested that the government needs to take some steps on getting physicians onto different kinds of payment plans and potentially controlling the flow of physicians into urban areas in particular. And so the government has come up with a way to do that. And this was also in Bill 21, which is going forward, the minister is going to have more power over issuing billing permits. This is the code that physicians are given to actually bill a province for services. And they are going to try to put conditions on those billing permits that says you may only practice in this part of the province, and you may only practice if you agree to be paid in a certain way. So that's going to be interesting.
Alberta Medical Association had some thoughts on this.
Yeah,
though.
The Alberta Medical Association, not too happy about this. And so there is a possibility. There was a court case a number of years ago that suggested these kind of geographical restrictions where you try to force doctors to work in a particular place may not be constitutional. It may just also not work, right? How many doctors are you going to get to say you're only allowed to practice in Alberta if you work in Elk Point or Vegreville or wherever? That may not actually produce the kind of results that you're looking for. So that's a big thing. And the other thing is they're putting in a clause that says we can terminate our agreement with doctors at any point that we want after a quote unquote reasonable period of negotiations, which hasn't been defined. And it's not just the current agreement that's in place with the Alberta Medical Association, it's any future agreement. So again, the AMA not too happy about that. And so we'll see how that goes, how that plays out going forward.
Sort of lopsided power structure there, hey?
The government is protecting itself, right? And their argument for all of this is they need to protect their investments. They need to make sure that costs don't get out of control. We have seen that in the past with doctors on occasion, that the costs have gone far beyond what has been budgeted. Mm-hmm. And so this is the government saying we're protecting itself. The problem is it may not be legal. And you can see any group not wanting to get into a deal with the government if the deal can be cut up at any point.
Okay, we're going to move on to the most technical part of this podcast. Get comfortable, crack your knuckles, get ready for graphs and charts and numbers. So
I can't crack my knuckles.
Okay, I can. Sort of. I can mostly on one side. Anyway, lots of practice there. So as you know, Alberta used to have a consumer carbon tax, which was eliminated. That was bill number one by the UCP government. Carbon tax, gone. No more tax on hockey moms driving to hockey practice or seniors heating their homes. Those are the examples that the premier likes to give. But there was still a carbon tax or a carbon price on heavy emitters. So oil companies, electrical companies, cement factories, I learned this week. Anyway, fun fact. So what the Kenny government did, though, was said, well, we are going to modify the way that that occurs. And Alberta's had a couple of these plans over the years. The first one started in 2007, I want to say, under the Stelmet
government. Yeah, Stelmet government put it in.
Take me back. The NDP had its own plan that did not penalize so much the facilities that were better on emissions, they said. And now there is a new hybrid plan, they call it. They call it TIER. And we shall cry some tears for the old NDP industrial carbon tax. And Keith is like super into this. So he's going to fill us in. He is super into he's super into this.
I write about it. Doesn't mean I
love
it.
No, he loves it. No, I mean love. You love that. You love the detail, the mechanisms here. So tell us what's different about this plan compared to the last plan? What did we learn on Tuesday about it? And what's good in this plan and what's maybe not so good?
Okay. Well, this definitely falls into the category of important but boring. And the important part is that this is Alberta's message to the rest of Canada and the rest of the world about how we are going to deal with climate change. This is our signature plan that we're putting out to say we are serious about the emissions that are created by heavy emitters, and particularly in the oil sands, right?
That's serious about 55% of the emissions,
right?
Because it only covers 55% of the emissions. The other 45% right, that the consumers and non-factories make, we don't know what they're doing with that yet. Anyway,
right.
Well, that's going to fall under Justin Trudeau's carbon tax unless the province wins its court battle
if
against
we don't,
the feds.
Yeah, court. Okay.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Go on.
So this is an important thing for Alberta, right? A lot of the country is going to be looking at this. So to go back to the NDP's plan, basically, there was a price on carbon that heavy emitters had to pay, right? And they had the option, if they exceeded their limits, to pay into a fund or to have these things called emissions credits, which they could then sell to other people in the industry. The way that the NDP system worked, it was done kind of on a product base. So everybody within the same sector had to pay the same price. They were at the same rate. So this gave an advantage to the cleanest facilities, the ones that were already most efficient. They got the most emissions credits. They got the biggest rewards. When the UCP decided to change the system, their initial plan was, well, let's flip that and actually have facility-based, individualized-based targets. So each facility didn't have to weigh itself against its competitors in the same sector. All they had to do was beat their own historical emissions. So even the dirtiest facilities, they only had to improve by 10%, and then 11% the next year, and 12%. It goes up by 1%. So it flips. It's essentially giving the better rewards to the dirtier facilities. They have the most room to improve. The really efficient facilities, the cleanest ones, they don't have much room to improve. They're already at the top of the food chain. So they actually get less rewards under that system. So that was what the UCP was going to do. But as you said, they've now come up with a hybrid system. They've changed from their campaign platform. They have kept the facility-based targets for the dirtier facilities, but they've also carried over from the NDP plan this high performance standard as well for the really good facilities that allows them the advantages that they had in the past as well. So the question has to be asked. If you're giving the great advantages to the dirtier facilities and you're giving the great advantages to the high-performing facilities, who's being disadvantaged here? Who's really under pressure to actually get cleaner, right? And I think that is sort of the big flaw in this system. The other thing that should be mentioned is the UCP was planning to reduce the price from $30 a ton to $20 a ton. Industry apparently told them, no, just go up to $30 a ton because that's what the federal standard is going to be come January.
Or stay at $30 a ton,
stay at $30 a ton. That's right. So that is a positive change. What we don't know is that the federal standards are going up to $40 and then $50. And when we asked Jason Nixon, the environment minister, is Alberta's program also going to move to 40 and 50? He didn't really answer the question. He basically said, well, that's a hypothetical and we'll talk to industry about that when it comes down. Right. So there have been some slight improvements here. But again, I wonder if there really is enough pressure on industry, at any portion of the industry, to actually get cleaner in this system.
There's also two standards, right? Like there's one for electricity and for oil and gas, right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And the
electricity portion is actually a good one. And so some of the economists agree with this. The electricity sector has to meet a standard of good as best gas, right? They basically have to get to a point where they are meeting emission targets as best gas-powered facilities. And that should put a lot of pressure, especially on the coal producers, to find ways to get cleaner and may actually prevent them from using coal in the future at all.
Right. But then they said, oh, well, it's more competitive for oil and gas. They face much more competition from the international marketplace. So basically, we have to give them more forgiveness. And it turns out there's also, if you're an oil and gas company and you have like a super bad year, there's an exception for you. You can get out of paying some of your...
Like a super bad year financially. Yes, not a super bad year emissions-wise. Oh, we burned off a whole lot of carbon.
We made 9 million
break,
tons of carbon. No. I mean, if they have a very bad financial year, there are exemptions for them to not pay into this fund. And maybe Dave can talk us through... They're going to collect a bunch of money, right? And then what are they going to do with this money? And how is that money going to change? That is not, he's giving me a look like that's not at all what I was going to talk about.
Yeah, I'm not. What is the money going for?
Well, let me tell you. Thanks for asking, Dave.
First off, I do want to say that, I mean, it's good that the province is aligning with the federal carbon plan on heavy emitters. It's just funny that they're all like, well, okay, we'll go in on the federal plan on heavy emitters so we don't have a plan imposed on us. But on the consumer carbon tax, it's like, well, we're going
to
fight it.
We'll fight to the death. Yes.
But that is good. And the fact that industry wants it shows that industry knows. And I think industry has known for a while that they need to do better. And so the government, who has said we need to listen to experts, if they want to listen to industry, that's a good thing. And keeping the price at 30 as opposed to 20, like they had campaigned on, is probably a good thing. So they're like, it's a sign that at least on some files that the government is willing to listen to outside experts or the federal government, even shockingly, or even the government that they defeated in May, that they're open to different ideas on this. So that's a positive. Whether it will do as they say it will, you know, I'm curious to see how it will go. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously something that we'll see over the next number of years.
Right. So unlike the climate leadership plan, which was the NDP's regime on carbon taxing, where they had the consumer and the industrial carbon tax, the revenues from that were supposed to kind of go up and up and up each year, even though it was supposed to curb emissions in the long term. But the revenues from TIER are supposed to go down and down and down. And also, the law under the NDP's plan was very strict about how you could spend the money. It had to be spent on consumer rebates, or it had to be spent reducing the small business tax, like offsetting the loss from that, or it had to be spent on very specific programs to try and reduce emissions. And one of the major criticisms from the opposition is that this money that they collect through these industrial carbon taxes are going into general revenue or some are going to research programs for technology to reduce emissions. So Keith, what are your thoughts on how they're using the money they collect?
Well, I think there are some drawbacks here. So yeah, a significant portion of this, the revenue is going to go to what they call deficit reduction, right? It's just going to go right into the general revenue pot. It has nothing to do with emissions reductions, it's having to do with deficit reduction. So that the government says they've always been clear about that. So that's part of it. It's also going to fund the war room, or what are we calling now, the Canadian Energy Center?
Canadian Energy Center.
Yeah, exactly.
So $20 million.
That's right. So that also nothing to do with emissions. It's basically just to tell the story about how great our emissions reduction plan is to the rest of the world, but doesn't actually curb emissions. So that's a significant portion of that revenue. The other parts of it are going to, in theory, technologies and innovation that will help reduce emissions further. And there's a bunch of vague technologies that they're not really discussing at great length at this point. One of those is carbon capture and storage, which has a very spotty history of being really expensive and not very effective. There are reports now that technology has turned a bit of a corner, and it is starting to get better, and that we may actually start to see some tangible cost reduction benefits there, and emissions reductions benefits. We'll see. But again, this is a lot of money going to unproven, yet to be invented technology that hopefully will produce results, but there's no guarantee. And we may not find out if some of this stuff fails for years to come.
And I can't remember whether it was Jason Nixon, the environment minister, or the president of Emissions Reduction Alberta, who said on Tuesday at a news conference, like, yeah, some of the technology we invest in is going to fail. But I mean, and I've worked in research, I understand, like, sometimes a failure is information, right? It's mm-hmm. information you can use to say, like, no, bacteria can't eat all our carbon emissions. Cool. Okay, now we know. Or whatever. So, I mean, even a negative result is a result. Research is not linear. I don't know. It sounds like there are some really cool things going on. I think maybe the government has an opportunity here to try and help us and the public learn a little bit more about what some of these cool projects are that they're funding. It might be advantageous to learn more about what this kind of research is that's supposed to make a difference in emissions reduction. Anyway, enough about that, enough hot air. We will move on to the good stuff from the gallery. Lisa.
There was good stuff?
Well, us. We're good stuff. No, of course.
Our outfits yesterday were bang on point.
We were, the press gallery's Halloweening was pretty excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had some good, it was all very professional, but we looked very thematic. I said to my child, I need to wear something today that's purple for Purple Thursday, Halloween-y, and appropriate for an Oil by Rail press conference. And he's like, oh, Mom, what a weird life you have. So Lisa, what did you read, listen to, hear this week that you would recommend to our beloved listeners?
Oh, this is the fun part.
This is the fun part.
Okay.
She's holding a bill, you guys.
It's not a bill. No, it's just notes.
Whew.
I'm sorry.
I thought it was like a piece of legislation. I was like, no.
It's happening, Janet. You've gotten dome disease. Everything looks like
dome
a bill. You've only been there a few weeks.
I would
already
recommend Bill 20 and all of its 100 glorious pages. Go on.
I mean, after a long day at the legislature, I like to wash my brain out with a really nice episode of Schitt's Creek.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen the show?
Oh, yeah. Eugene Levy. Awesome. Yeah.
I mean, I know it's already been talked about and it's not like a revelation to anybody, but Catherine O'Hara's character lights up my world.
Aww.
Like, she has every single line. And if I had time on my hands, I would turn them all into like gifts and share them with friends and family for like Christmas or something, like every single line. She's got this like strange, indecipherable accent that you can't quite figure out. And she says, I wrote this word down. She says words like pettifogging.
It's a good word. It's a very good word. Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds awesome. Dave, what have you been reading, hearing, listening?
I'm going to recommend a podcast. I've previously recommended the Slate podcast Slow Burn on the show. The first two seasons looked at the Nixon impeachment and the Clinton impeachment, respectively. season three takes a big sharp left turn, and it may turn off some of the listeners who are really into politics. Like, they're finding the niche audience of people who are into politics, but also into rap music. Season three is Slow Burn, Biggie, and Tupac, and it will look into the murders of Tupac Shakur and Notorious B.I.G. The episode one drops. It's all about Tupac and kind of how he was shot in 1994 and what kind of sparked that beef. And, you know, I may be in the weeds for some of you listeners out there who don't care about Biggie and Tupac, but they were amazing rap artists in the 90s, and definitely based on the first episode, it's going to be a really good listen.
I will jump in here and tell you about a book I just read. I like to read old books because I did a degree in chemistry and biochemistry, so I haven't read any like literature or books.
It's overrated.
Yeah, but it's informative context. Anyway, okay, so one of the things I like to do just end up happening is there's a lot of like abandoned books lying around our newsroom. And one I found was back from the 90s, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Are we allowed to take those books?
I do. Who's going to stop you? I'm giving away all my secrets here. Anyhow, I'll bring it back. I've completely wrecked the cover, so nobody wants it, but because I destroy the books that I love. But it was a really fascinating look, and it got made into a movie. And it's just John Berendt is this author from New York, and he went and kind of like went on this trip to Savannah, just kind of poking around, and ended up spending like the better part half of his life for like 8 years there, just learning about all these zany characters in this weird sort of isolated city that doesn't seem to interact with much of the rest of America. And now I just really want to go to Savannah because it sounds amazing. Anyway, Keith, take us home.
I struggled a bit this week because there was a lot of news going on. So I was looking for like the definitive piece on Encana moving its headquarters out of Calgary. I was looking for something on the oil by rail, and that announcement from and our coverage was very good there.
Dave is hoarding all the chocolates. Dave,
I saw that too.
Sorry.
It's all right. Fine. Yeah, I see what reverence you give to my good stuff this week.
I'm riveted.
Anyway, all of that stuff, I think what you folks should read on edmontonjournal.com. However, for a little slightly more fun read, I found something in Vice called I Accidentally Uncovered a Nationwide Scam on Airbnb.
Cool.
And sort of this kind of plays out like a bit like a mystery, a whodunit. I've stayed in Airbnbs. I just came back from Italy where we stayed in Airbnbs. So this was a bit frightening to find that there is some vulnerabilities in that system and people can be taken advantage of. And it was one woman's journey here to find out how she had been scammed on a trip to Chicago. That was quite interesting.
Well, I am totally distracted by my email now and I am the worst press gallery host ever. Sorry. As we were, that is all we have for today on the press gallery. Candy rustling, weird recommendations about Airbnb, carbon tax analysis. You got it all here. Join us next week for the next episode of the Press Gallery.